Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
And welcome to another edition of Inside Sources, except instead of having Boyd Matheson, you were joined this afternoon by Greg Skordis and Rusty Cannon. Rusty, you and I have worked on a couple of shows at KSL at night, but it's fun to be with you on a live daytime show.
Yeah, it's my first live show, and I've got all kinds of buttons in front of me. I either just turned on my mic or launched a missile, one of the two.
There you go.
So I've got all kinds of buttons that I don't think I'm supposed to touch, but I'm ready to go.
And just looking at the 50 degrees and rain outside, it's probably good to be inside the studio with you.
Good day for radio, yes.
You know, I've learned something working with you, and that is that you and I share this sort of geekiness about politics.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because this weekend are the state Republican and Democratic conventions. And I'm going to talk about the Republican one first because we have a guest that's going to help us. But I'm watching very, very closely three races. And they're all important. But these are the three that and they're sort of open races. The Senate position, Mitt Romney's open seat.
Yeah, that's a big one.
House District 2. I know Celeste Malloy is there now, but
She just barely got there.
Yeah, I mean, she's been there for like 5 months. I think some people are looking at that almost like an open seat. John Curtis opened his seat by running for Senate, so House District 3, and of course the Attorney General's race. Yeah. Those are the four that I'm watching closely tomorrow just to see what happens. And you and I are going to break some of those down a little bit later in the second segment. But for the first segment, we are lucky to be joined this afternoon by Brigham Tomko, staff writer for the Deseret News, who covers politics, who's going to be at the convention tomorrow. Brigham, thanks for joining us again.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You're kind of always with us and always available, and I really appreciate that. So talk to us about the Senate race. I mean, there's been some controversy there. It's an open seat. It's Mitt Romney's seat. I think a lot of people thought that John Curtis jumping in would sort of seal the deal. But I think Brad Wilson jumped in very quickly.
Oh, Brad was in very early.
Yeah. And he was there. But it's even opened up a little bit past that. Tell us where that sits tomorrow.
Sure. So there are 10 Republican candidates vying for this seat. Maybe half of those feel like they have a more serious shot at emerging from the convention or qualifying for the primary ballot via signature gathering. And some of them are already guaranteed to be on that primary ballot in June, like Representative John Curtis, Brad Wilson, who was the House Speaker in Utah, and Trent Staggs, the mayor of Riverton.
Or Jason Walton. Jason Walton's the other one with the signatures.
Yeah, sorry.
In the Senate race, yeah.
You're right. Jason Walton was the other one with the certified signatures. And so a big stepping back, I think, and looking at this race, you see people trying to differentiate themselves as the most Mike Lee-esque candidate. None of them are trying to run as a Mitt Romney 2.0, and I don't know what that says about the direction of the party or the state convention, but they're all trying to frame themselves as the most loyal to the Constitution, the most loyal to cutting spending and these kinds of talking points.
So speaking of Mike Lee, has he endorsed a particular candidate in this race? And maybe I should ask you that also, Rusty. Do you know Brigham, if he has?
He has not.
No, I believe he's been silent on this race, as far as I know.
Yeah, and maybe for good reason. So break it down. Like I said earlier, I think we all thought John Curtis was in the driver's seat, but it's become a little bit closer race, at least it appears to be.
Yeah, there's been scant polling on this. The Deseret News polled the Senate race a few months ago. A private organization called Noble Predictive Insights released a poll yesterday, and the big takeaway is that nearly half of Utah Republican primary voters are undecided. And so although John Curtis held a sizable lead in both of those polls, most people don't know who they're voting for yet. And so John Curtis has more name ID. He has more fundraising momentum in this first quarter. He has more connections maybe within the Utah political community, certainly at the federal level, but it's up in the air who's going to emerge from the convention.
So another interesting thing about tomorrow is you'll have some that tomorrow is really could be the end of the road, right? So you mentioned the signature gathering candidates, Jason Walton, John Curtis, and Brad Wilson in the Senate race, but here's an interesting wrinkle, Brent Hatch. And I was excited that you just, in your article, had him listed as Brent Hatch, because every single ad that I hear reminds everybody what his middle name is, right? And so it's kind of, I'm glad. You get credit in my book for doing that. and just having his first name. But he's only turned in 21,035 signatures right now. So as long as you turn them in before the deadline, which my understanding is they were turned in.
And you need 28,000.
But you need 28,000. Right. So it's my understanding they're still counting for him. And so if he gets the 28,000 at some point, no matter how he does on tomorrow, he could have a shot. But other than that, these other folks have to get 40% to get out of there.
Well, a quick correction there. The signature gathering path has now closed for Brent Hatch. He originally submitted over 41,000 signatures by the deadline 2 weeks ago. But yesterday, the lieutenant governor's office said that he does not have enough certified signatures to qualify for the primary ballot via that pathway. And so his hopes are completely in the hands of state delegates tomorrow.
All right. Well,
Rusty,
that's an interesting wrinkle.
You had a little... You've got some different information about that, I thought.
Yeah. My understanding was that, no, the lieutenant governor's office would be the ultimate arbiter of this, but that if they were turned in before the deadline, they can continue to count, and then if at some point you get that 28,000, you can get on the primary ballot. But
well, the problem with Brent Hatch's signatures is that lots of them did not meet snuff. They did not qualify and so could not certify. So despite turning in, like I said, over 40,000 signatures, he wasn't able to get the 28,000.
That's a pretty
mark.
High error rate. That's surprising.
There was lots of talk, lots of rumors swirling around that it got towards the end of that period when they could gather signatures, and they started dumping money into signature gathering firms that are quick but not as effective.
Well, so in an interesting fact, so Greg, if you sign for me as a candidate a signature and I turn it in first, you're done. But then if you forget and go sign someone else's, and oh, yeah, I like you, I'll sign yours too, and then they turn yours in, it gets rejected because it's only one signature per voter per candidate, right? So you get to the end of the cycle and the pool gets pretty thin, right?
Yeah, I've been told a rule of thumb is that for every candidate that has already submitted the signatures ahead of you, you'll probably lose another 7% of the signatures that you turn in.
Wow.
And in addition to those factors you mentioned before, that they have to be registered Republicans, right?
Correct. That's a big test as well.
And with respect to Hatch, I guess what we're hearing is half of his signatures are invalidated.
Well, if
you say he turned
000,
in 40-some thousand, he's got 21. I mean, that seems like a lot of – that's a high error rate.
And the calculation they may have made is – maybe they didn't finish counting all of the signatures, but they knew that even if they did count all the rest of the signatures, and even if they were all certified, he still wouldn't have met that bar of 28,000. And so they probably stopped before they needed to go through every single one because they knew there was no way he could make it at that point.
So, plan to be at the convention all day tomorrow?
I'll be at the convention all day tomorrow covering these statewide and congressional races.
So are you packing a lunch? You're going to need a lunch, several bottles of water, maybe some snacks. Having been through these, you're going to want to – and comfortable shoes. You need comfortable shoes. Have you got all that ready to go?
I have it ready to go.
Okay. Good.
Hopefully it's an exciting thing and I won't leave people dozing off. And
well, the interesting fact as well is some of those other candidates that don't have signatures, they have got to hit 40% or they're done tomorrow, right? So that would be Trent Staggs, Carolyn Phippen. And there are some others that I'm not recalling there, but some active campaigns that could end tomorrow.
Yeah, it'll certainly narrow down the field, but we're still likely to have 5 to 6 candidates in the primary ballot.
Wow. Well, Brigham, thanks for joining us this afternoon, and we'll be looking forward to your reporting on it. It's probably in Sunday's paper.
Thank you very much.
And when we come back after the break, Rusty, I want to continue this conversation and talk about the other races that I mentioned at the top of the show. Stay with us.
Get deeper insights on the news from Inside Sources.
Welcome back to Inside Sources. I'm your host this afternoon, Greg Skordis, alongside Rusty Cannon. We're talking, Rusty, about the Republican convention tomorrow. We may talk about the Democrats a little bit, too. But we had Brigham Tomko for the first segment, and I was interested in the four open races. We talked about the Senate race, but I want to ask you a little bit about the other races that go down ballot.
Yeah.
And first of all, I didn't understand, and I think a lot of our listeners may not understand the whole signature gathering process. It's controversial. It's caused some problems, but it does allow a person, and it looks like each race has its own number of signatures you have to get, which is based apparently on some percentage of the people in your district. But if you get through the if you get enough signatures, you're on the ballot for the primary.
For the primary, yeah. Yeah.
Otherwise, you've got to get what?
You need to get 40% to come out of convention.
Okay.
Right? So if you gather signatures and you meet the threshold, so for instance, in a congressional race, it's 7,000 signatures for any of those seats. And if you get that before the deadline, which is roughly 2 weeks before the convention, you're on the primary ballot. It says right there on the website. But if not, you need to get at least 40% to come out of convention to get into the primary. And so there's both dynamics. And this was an outgrowth of a long battle. I think it's about a decade ago where the settlement, I would call it, was, okay, well, we'll have two paths. And you can go the convention route or gather the signatures. The alternative at the time, as far as memory, and I'm sure I might get this wrong, was that the convention system could have gone away. And this was a way to preserve both, or at least you have the alternative right. And still keep the old. And so that's where we are now. So it's been about 10 years, I think.
Okay, so let's talk about House District 2. This is the seat currently held by Celeste Malloy.
Yep.
We know that it was Chris Stewart's seat. He mm-hmm. he resigned a little bit early. There was almost like a special election November of last year. Mm-hmm. She was in that seat. So we would have thought she's in that seat now. She's been pretty active. We've seen her a lot. Mm-hmm. To me, I would have thought that's an incumbent's position. Republicans step aside. But there have been a number of people jumping in opposing her in this race. And I think she's in for a little bit of a fight tomorrow.
So tomorrow is going to be a big day for Congressional District 2. You have several candidates on the Republican side, obviously, including Celeste Malloy. There's also Ty Jensen and Colby Jenkins. And I might be leaving. No, I think that was it on the list there as far as the Republican side.
And none of them have done the signature process.
Yeah. So the tomorrow matters. And so you need to come out of there with that 40%. It's been a pretty active campaign between all of them. And yesterday it was shaken up a little bit. You yeah. had an endorsement.
Surprise endorsement to me.
Yeah,
absolutely.
It surprised a lot of people. Mike Lee endorsing Colby Jenkins. And Celeste Malloy will battle it out with him and the others in the race tomorrow. So it will be a very, very interesting day.
Okay, so I'm looking at the Republicans, and let's say that there are three. We have Celeste Malloy, we have Colby Jenkins, and we have Ty Jensen.
Yeah.
So they'll go through a round of ballots, and they'll eliminate a person at each round,
correct.
Theoretically.
Yeah, theoretically.
That's why
yeah.
you get the 40%, because if one person gets 60%, that means over. Nobody got 40.
Yeah.
Then it's over. That person's on the ballot.
Yeah, then they're the party nominee on the primary ballot at that point.
So let's say that one person's eliminated in the first round, the other two go, and they're both, 45 versus 55%. Mm-hmm. They're both on the Republican
yep, both
primary
the
ballot.
Primary. Yep. Yep.
Okay.
If you get 40 point whatever fraction you want to use, 0.001, you're in. If you have 39.9999, what have you, depending on the percentage, you're out.
Yeah. Okay. And I don't know if you can break this down for us too, Rusty, but what do you suppose was behind Mike Lee's endorsement of her opponent, given that he has to have been working with her fairly closely? I mean, the Utah delegation, mm-hmm. Senate and House, they apparently have breakfast once a week, and they talk and they meet. And
yeah.
And I think he was a big supporter of hers back in November.
You know, that's an open I don't want to speak out of turn. I would assume, I mean, there are votes that have happened since Representative Malloy has been in Congress that have been, not controversial just on one congresswoman's part, but on all of Congress. The NDAA authorization, the FISA vote, there was a budget vote, appropriations essentially. And those were pretty heated, all of them. And depending on where you come down on those, can rub some people the wrong way or vice versa. Perhaps that's part of it.
Yeah.
But I'm sure a lot of people will be wanting to talk to the senator tomorrow at the convention.
Yeah. Okay, and let's talk about House District 3. This is the one that's vacated by John Curtis's running for Senate. So it's an open seat.
Yep.
I see four names, maybe five.
Oh, there's a lot of people. I think it's up to 10.
I see four names that have got the signatures.
Correct.
That are moving on.
Yeah, those moving on, J.R. Byrd, Case Lawrence, Stuart Pay, and John Frugal-Dougal, even have his middle name listed on the website there. They've all gotten over 7,000 signatures verified, and they are all listed as qualified for the primary. So no matter what happens tomorrow, there will be at least four people on the third congressional district ballot in June.
And the only way there would be a fifth name is if someone else gets at least 40% and
yes,
and the final ballot.
Correct.
So people will be eliminated. There'll be final two. There may be, there could be as many as two more people on the ballot besides these four. Unlikely. You would assume that one of these four, maybe two of them will end up on there.
Yeah.
Any names on there that strike you as particularly interesting? I mean, Dougal, he's currently our
state auditor. Yeah, he's been state auditor for, I think it's been well over a decade. He
seems to enjoy that position.
Oh, he's been, I think
that's
one
why
of,
he
one
uses the middle name Frugal because he's the auditor.
Yeah, I think that was a campaign slogan that came around when he first ran a long time ago. I remember I was there when he was running and that middle name stuck. And then, you know, J.R. Byrd, we interviewed him on the night show the other night.
He's the mayor of Roosevelt?
Mayor of Roosevelt, yep, yep.
Out in the basement. Very impressive.
Yeah.
You know, I really enjoyed him.
I think all delegates would agree.
Frugal,
these
I've
are
listened
all great
to
candidates.
Speak before. He's a wonderful.
Yeah.
I love the guy.
Yeah. And Case Lawrence, a business owner. I see him a lot on billboards, things like that. And Stuart Pay. They're all, I think, I'm not a state delegate. So my day might be a little shorter tomorrow for a lot of people, but these are all good candidates.
Yeah.
And I could see a virtual tie across the board just from judging all of these. But I don't know. It'll be an interesting horse race to watch.
And there are a couple of others we should mention that didn't go the signature process. And I'm looking at the Republicans in House District 3 that didn't get enough signatures or didn't try, I guess. Mm-hmm. Catherine Dallin, Lucky Bovo, and Clayton Hunsaker, also Republicans running for that seat. So we really have seven candidates tomorrow.
Well, you also have Senator Mike Kennedy. So State Senator Mike Kennedy, he's running for
House District 3. Oh, I'm looking at the signature.
Yeah, and so he's not up right now for his state Senate seat, and he's running here. He has, if I remember correctly, ran against Romney the first time around, if I remember right. But he is very popular with delegates. I mean, there are a lot of names in here that could make this a very interesting day.
Yeah, and a long day. If you start with eight
and
you've got to get down to two.
Yeah, I don't know how long they each get to speak, but I don't know, call it 4 minutes. I don't know what the time limit will be, but you start doing the multiples. Now, the good news is that the voting will be electronic, and it should go pretty fast and help with that. And let's just all pray that there isn't an effort to go away from that, because it will turn that into a Monday morning meeting.
Okay, and I didn't time this very well, Rusty, because I wanted to talk about three races, and I thought I have 5 minutes for each one, but I really don't. But so can you give us 30 seconds on the AG race?
Yeah, AG race. Derek Brown. He's gathered enough signatures to where he will be on the primary ballot. I believe he's the only one. So anyone else that wants to be on the Republican side, at least, Rachel Terry, Trent Christensen, and a Frank Mylar. Any of them would need 40 to get onto that primary ballot, or it'll just be Derek.
Yeah. So that'll be an interesting show, and you're going to be there. I forget what your role is.
They have special elections in the morning for some of the legislative districts that are smaller, that cross county lines, and so we'll be running those between 8 and 10 a.m. I have to help with one of those. But they'll wrap up by 10, and then everybody gets to the big meeting at 10:30. So.
All right. Well, interesting. I'm going to love reading the paper Sunday morning and going to the Deseret News and finding out what happened. Brigham Tomko, who was with us earlier, is going to be covering that, and then you're going to be covering that as well. So, yeah, let's watch these conventions tomorrow and support those. If you're a delegate, go there and listen and tell us how it goes. Democrats are having theirs at the same time at Cottonwood High School, my alma mater.
That's right.
When we come back, we'll talk about some local stories of interest.
Hear elevated conversation on crucial issues. Boyd Matheson on Inside Sources.
Welcome back to Inside Sources. Today, I am one of your co-hosts for Inside Sources, Rusty Cannon. I'm here with the one and only Greg Skordas. Greg, we've made it through two segments. We're on our third, and I have not pushed a wrong button yet.
Well, not that you know of.
No, that's true.
There you
that's
go.
True. Missiles might have flown out of a silo right. somewhere. But
you haven't hit the ejection seat yet.
That's right.
So you're still with us.
We're still rolling. So this segment's going to be really interesting. If you are a business owner, you're going to want to pay attention. If you haven't heard already, the FTC issued a rule, essentially voted on a rule this week about non-competes. So, Greg, as you know, as an attorney, these non-competes. So if you work for me and I share all of my secret sauce with you about the great, you know, how great my product is, or trade secret or what have you, I will often then have you sign a non-compete, right? To say, so you can't take those secrets and then go and compete against me. Some believe that's a good practice. Some believe it's not. But this week, the FTC voted 3-2 to essentially ban these for almost all workers in the United States. Like, this is a big deal. Where
30 million workers are affected by this. Correct. I had no idea, Rusty, yeah, that 30 million Americans, I think it's something like 1 in 5 or 1 in 7 workers,
yes,
are currently under a non-compete. I don't know many people that are, personally, but I guess I don't know what everybody's contract is.
I've seen them before. It is more common than you think. And there's a very good case on both sides. I land on one side, but there are two sides to this story. But we wanted to bring on a guest that is going to be able to give us some really good details on what this really means and what happens from here. So if you go back to Washington, D.C., there is probably not a more connected organization than the Business Roundtable in D.C. They know what they're doing, and they are involved in just about every conversation back there. And today we have on with us Corey Astell, who is a vice president at the Business Roundtable, a good man and good friend. Corey, thank you for joining us on the show today.
Great to be here. Thanks a lot, Rusty.
So for those that haven't heard, if you can just, we sort of summed it up there, but what does this mean to the business world? Because this, I would assume, is going to end or start some serious litigation.
It is going to have a profound effect on the business world. So just to take a step back, the Federal Trade Commission issued a rule to ban non-compete agreements, declaring them unfair method of competition in violation of Section 5 of the FTC Act. So as you mentioned, non-compete agreements are something long used in the business world to prevent employees from leaving the business to go work for a competitor or start a competing business. And they do this so that, you know, they can keep their employees who've received training and insider knowledge and keep them from turning around and joining a competitor. So the FTC's ban applies prospectively, basically moving forward, to all workers at all levels of a business, regardless of income or seniority. And it also applies to all current employees that are existing now, except what they call senior executives. And those are folks who work in policymaking positions and make a certain threshold of salary. So what this means is that the rule bans nearly all current and future uses of non-compete agreements. And as you mentioned, the FTC is already facing significant legal challenges. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce has led a group of business organizations, including the Business Roundtable, in filing a lawsuit yesterday. Other business organizations and industry associations have made similar announcements about filing their own separate lawsuits in the coming days. And these lawsuits will address the broad and sweeping implications of this rule. You know, this area of law is typically the purview of state law. So here in Utah, we have state laws that govern non-compete agreements. It can't exceed 1 year. It has to be supported by consideration, which is a legal term meaning like the employee has to get something in return. It has to be negotiated in good faith and limited to a geographical area. And states are the ones who make these decisions through the legislature. And it varies widely. In California, they've banned it completely. And in some states, they have salary thresholds or it's limited to certain professions. But this rule is broad and sweeping, as I said, includes basically everyone. And the challenges on this rule are going to be based on whether the FTC has exceeded its authority under the FTC Act, as well as under the U.S. Supreme Court's major questions doctrine. So give you a little background. Section 5 of the FTC Act directs the FTC to prevent unfair methods of competition or unfair and deceptive practices. But that statute also specifies that the FTC needs to pursue these objectives through adjudication. And what we mean by that is through individual cases. So the FTC has not traditionally had the ability to regulate from on high, as many agencies have that power. But the FTC is supposed to make decisions on a case-by-case basis to look at a given trade practice in a particular case at a particular moment in time, because market dynamics continually change, the industries always change and vary widely. And so the real point is that Congress probably has not given the FTC authority to start promulgating competition regulations at this level. And so that's going to be litigated.
And Corey, I want to ask you a question that Rusty sort of touched on a little bit. The FTC did distinguish between non-disclosure agreements and non-compete agreements. And they said that non-disclosure agreements are still in place so that if an employee leaves a company with trade secrets or information about the customer list or something like that, I think the FTC is falling back and saying, look, you still have employers still have an avenue to make sure that the employee doesn't hurt them. So that's remained in effect, but that doesn't seem to be satisfying some of the groups that you're talking about here.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I mean, preserving that area of law is important, but you still have specialized training that's given to employees. You know, employees invest heavily. Many companies and businesses will invest heavily in their employees to give them training. And this creates a huge disincentive for them to make those investments. And senior executives, yes, they're not allowed to share trade secrets, but they still have confidential information. They still have understanding of the business's strategic plans. And so, you know, it's a fine line. And the two of those areas of law do go kind of hand in hand. And on the one hand, I think that the business world is happy with keeping non-disclosures. But this is another area that, I mean, there's a lot of crossover in that space. So
Corey, could anything be done about this legislatively? Let's say they actually do something in the Senate or Congress on this issue. Could they, or is this just out of their ballpark at this point?
Yeah, there are two things that Congress could do. There's really two avenues to take. One is in statute is a tool called the Congressional Review Act. And what that allows Congress to do is with a majority vote of the House and Senate, but then signed by the president, you can nullify an agency rule. Now, in this case, the Democrats are in control of the Senate, and obviously we have a Democratic President Biden. So that's not very likely to work. And those have been used very sparingly in the past, but it really requires a single party holding all three, House, Senate, and presidency, and being a rule coming from the other party. And so that's probably not going to happen. The other avenue would be Congress just legislate in this area, you know, come in and say maybe set the rules and I guess divide the power between the states and the federal government. That would still be challenged, probably still be challenged in court on grounds of, is this the purview of state law or not? But those are two avenues that they could take. Both of those seem, in the current Congress, unlikely and a steep climb. And so really the main avenue and really almost the only avenue that opponents have to this is litigation.
Through the courts.
And it will be litigated and it will go through the courts and it'll take years. And what we've seen in recent years is this is what's happening with rules, is that large and very consequential major rules are put into effect and it takes years to litigate them. And in the meantime, we have change in administration and who might want to try to pull back on those rules or go forward even further. And so we do have this kind of yo-yo effect.
Well, that'll be quite a bit to watch. A lot of feathers flying, I'm sure, legally and everywhere else. Corey Astle, thank you for joining us. Corey Astle, Vice President of the Business Roundtable. An interesting issue. And Greg, as an attorney, I'm sure you'll maybe hear about this.
Watching this one.
So thanks for sticking with us. And we will be right back on Inside Sources.
Get deeper insights on the news from Inside Sources.
Welcome back to Inside Sources. Alongside Rusty Cannon, I'm Greg Skordis. And Rusty, I want to talk about a court case that I think surprised a lot of people.
We're talking about
Harvey Weinstein's conviction. If you recall, Harvey Weinstein was the Hollywood mogul that made a lot of people famous. He was apparently a genius at really... there's some programs and some ideas and some things that he did that were really innovative. But it turns out that there were a lot of women that had dealt with him over the years that had concerns about the way he treated them. And the list became astronomical. We got into 100 women who he had violated in some respects. Hmm. He was prosecuted in New York. And he was prosecuted in California. And he was convicted in both jurisdictions.
Yeah, he's in prison, right?
Right. He's currently in the New York prison, but that's about to end. Of course, he's going to go to the California prison, at least until that's done, because the New York Court of Appeals, which is their highest court, overturned his conviction and said that the judge allowed testimony in that case that should not have been allowed, and that the jury was prejudiced by that. And because of that mistake, this court called it an egregious error, egregious and improper rulings, that that jury's decision can't stand, and his conviction was reversed.
So what kind of issue was this about? Like, what did the judge do that would result in this?
I mean, yes. So it's a really interesting, and it's not a particularly complex legal argument, but Rusty, in cases where you deal with, and sex crimes are the perfect example, where you have what's called a he said, she said, mm-hmm. and there are rules that allow that the government can present evidence to sort of bolster what a victim might say if you can find other victims who have had similar interactions with the defendant.
Okay.
And we call that it's a rule of 404B. It doesn't matter, but there are certain things you don't allow, which is like character evidence, or you know, somebody's school teacher said, "Oh, he was the greatest kid in the world," or that mm-hmm. kind of thing. That's not relevant. Or even like if you have a DUI and you've got two prior DUIs, we don't allow that in because it doesn't mean you did or didn't commit the instant one. We have to focus the eyes on the prize. What happened in this particular case? So in this case, Weinstein was charged with sexually assaulting two women, raping two women. And so the government could have just put those two women on. And the problem they had is that there was some consensual contact between the two of them. And so that makes it much more difficult. I was the head of sex crimes at the Salt Lake DA's office. And anytime you have a series of consensual sexual encounters and then one isn't, juries are uncomfortable with that. So the government, to bolster the evidence, the testimony of these two women, brought in a series of other women who said, you know what, he did some things to me that were also inappropriate. And the jury, hearing the totality of all that evidence, said, you know what, we're going to find you guilty. And they did. The Court of Appeals there in New York said, wait a minute, you shouldn't have brought in these other victims, alleged victims, because their testimony was too distant. It wasn't necessarily related. Some of them were not even in the state of New York. Some of them were past what would have been a statute of limitations. And some of them were more what you'd call sexual harassment. In other words, inappropriate comments and conduct and things like that in the workplace, where the case that he was charged with was sexual misconduct, touching, you know, a physical case. So it's really a touchy issue, and it's a huge thing in the courts right now. But the Court of Appeals in New York said you shouldn't have allowed that evidence in. They threw it out. Now, that doesn't mean the case is over in New York. The government can still retry it. They just can't retry it with those particular witnesses, those corroborating, they thought, witnesses, because under the law, that's improper corroboration.
So they'd have to start over with different victims?
No. They can use the same victims. They just can't use the other witnesses who came in, the witnesses who corroborated and said, yeah, me too. He did it to me too. He did it to me too. And I use that phrase intentionally because this was part of the whole, Me Too movement. Well, wait a minute. We should be able to bring in that type of thing. And the law is pretty loose about it. Here's another hook, Rusty. Mm-hmm. In California, where he was also convicted, there was similar evidence brought in by the California prosecutors of witnesses, uncharged conduct by other witnesses. So now he's being released from the New York prison. He's going to go to California because he's got to serve 16 years there. But that case is still up on appeal in the California Supreme Court for the exact same alleged
same reason.
Misconduct by the judge.
So at this point, where does he go? I mean, he's still in prison, right?
Right,
he should stay in prison.
Well, he should stay. He's not going to stay in a New York prison because he's not guilty of that crime anymore. They threw it out. But he's convicted in California, so he's going to be shuffled to California, and he'll do his time there while that case is being appealed. If that case is overturned, he walks. He's a free man. Unless New York picks up the ball again, which their prosecutors are claiming they're going to do, and say, look, we're just going to retry it again. We just won't use that corroborative evidence.
Okay, so as an attorney, you would know this. How hard would it be for New York to rebuild the case and do it again and convict?
That's going to be a very hard thing for a couple reasons. One, you may have some witnesses, the underlying victims, the two that he was charged with, might say, you know what, I'm not going through that again. And that's absolutely their prerogative.
Yeah.
So if they have reluctant victims, that's a problem. They also, just by definition, the state, the prosecutors in the state of New York did feel that they had a weak case. And they did feel like in order to prevail, they needed to bring in these other witnesses, these other corroborative witnesses. And so they only did that because they wanted to make sure they had a strong case. They don't have that strong of a case anymore. Mm-hmm. Will they retry it again? My guess is they will. Mm-hmm. That the victims on the underlying charges themselves will still come in and testify. Just the state won't have all this other evidence that they can add to it so that the jury can see really the character of this man, the person that he is, that he's just a habitual groper.
So who made the error? Who how did this happen? This just, it seems hard to believe.
Yeah, you know, it's part of the appellate system. So the prosecution and the defense are getting ready for trial, and the prosecution says, Judge, we're going to call these six or eight witnesses. And the defense says, you can't call them. They're not related. They're not mm-hmm. close enough. And the judge makes a weighing decision. Mm-hmm. And he says, you know what? I'm looking at the law. I think, or he or she says, I'm looking at the law. I think that I can allow that testimony to come in. So the error was committed by the judge, mm-hmm. but judges only react. They don't create, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So they
yeah.
only react to what's in front of them. So it happens all the time. We have pretrial motions, mm-hmm. a motion to admit evidence, motion to exclude evidence. And those decisions are always looked on by the Court of Appeals depending on how the verdict came down. So when a verdict comes down, of course there are going to be appeals. Bill Cosby's another example.
Yeah,
basically walked.
Sounds familiar to Bill Cosby. Yeah.
Exactly. A very, very similar situation. And so the Court of Appeals looks at it and says, you know what, Judge? You really shouldn't have allowed that testimony. And by the way, it was a 4-3 decision by the New York Court of Appeals, and the three dissenters really hammered the majority and said, you've just taken the Me Too movement back decades. You've taken yeah. what we've tried to do for women's rights back a long time. You know what I mean? You've really stood.
But but that's not supposed to weigh in, though, right? I mean, is it? I mean, it should
yeah.
be the legal argument, right?
Right. It is. But they were. It was a pretty scathing dissent where the majority is saying, you know what? You have to have a fair trial.
Yeah.
You have to. Every case that's tried has to be heard on the facts of the case, the evidence that's there, and extraneous stuff has to be relevant enough and close enough in proximity that's admissible. Mm-hmm. And in this case, the Court of Appeals said, you know what, Judge, you went a little too far. If they try it again, we'll see. My guess is they probably have little choice.
Mm-hmm.
Their backdrop, of course, Rusty, is he's going to prison in California,
yeah.
16 years, maybe they'll feel like enough's enough. But mm-hmm. that case is in jeopardy, too.
So they essentially put him on a bus, drive him across the country to another prison? Is that how
yes,
that works?
That's almost exactly right,
wow.
to another prison. Well, when we come back after the break, we're going to go on campus and talk to one of our KSL at Night hosts to talk to us about what's going on American campuses all over. Stay with us.
KSL FM Midvale.
KSL Salt Lake City.
From the KSL Common Spirit Health Studios, this is KSL News Radio.
Utah's news, traffic, and weather station.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
And welcome to hour number two of Inside Sources, except I'm not Boyd Matheson. I'm Greg Skordis, and I'm alongside Rusty Cannon. Rusty, we got through the first hour, but the second hour is going to be even more fun, I think.
Even better.
We've got some stuff to talk about here. Last night on KSL at Night, I was co-hosting with Leah Murray, who is the executive director of the Walker Institute at Weber University, and she's our go-to person when it comes to what's going on college campuses.
Uh-huh.
And we talked for a minute, but I want to get into it a little bit more about what's going on college campuses right now with these protests. And it started, I think, at Harvard and Penn, and it's expanded into Columbia. I'm sure there are others where students are protesting what's going on in the Middle East right now. And maybe to help us break it down, because I'll just butcher it, let's bring Leah in. Leah, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Of course. It's so lovely to be with you.
And tell our listeners what's going on campus and why right now on some of these campuses.
Yeah. So first of all, I want to be a little nervous about being your go-to person, Greg, for what's happening on campuses, because my goodness, I don't want to answer for all the things. But basically what we see happening across the country, although I would argue I haven't seen it in Utah, and mostly it's happening at like elite colleges, if that makes sense. Like we're talking Harvard, we're talking Columbia, we're talking MIT, we're not talking public universities like we have in the state of Utah. A lot of students have a lot of feelings about what is happening in Gaza, right? So their concern is that the United States is pro-Israel. They wish that the country was a more, pro-Palestinian position, was taking a more pro-Palestinian position. And then just like I think all 18 to 22-year-olds do, they're at a college campus, they have a lot of time. You know, they don't have a job, right? So they actually have all this time. And so what they do is they end up, you know, they have a lot of time to think. They have a lot of activity, opportunity, if that makes sense. They're able to do things. And so this launches a lot of times in college campuses into protest when the young people are feeling like they're not being heard.
So, Leah, correct me if I'm wrong. A lot of these protests are taking part on private college campuses.
Correct.
And there was some news made as they cleared them out in Columbia University, I believe. But these private campuses have the absolute right to do that, right?
Have the absolute right to
clear out the students, right? If they're being disruptive or what have you.
Yeah.
It's private property and they can do that.
Rusty, that is such a good question. And I actually think goes right to the heart of it. So I think that administrators on a campus feel like they have the obligation to make sure campuses are a safe place for learning. So to a certain extent, that could include, you know what I mean, living with a little bit of protest. Does that make sense? Because you might be like, free speech matters and your right to peacefully assemble matters. And on a campus, maybe this is a good place to learn how to do that in a safe way. On the other hand, if you are a tent encampment, right, like so you're making it so that other students can't get to class, then you probably have an obligation to clear that out. The question at Columbia was whether the president had the prerogative to call in the New York Police Department, right? So they didn't use Columbia security to clear that out. Does that make sense? Like they brought in, you know, the city police, and a lot of students had a lot of problem with that choice being made, if that makes sense.
No, yeah. It makes a lot of sense, Leah. And let me ask you this. You and I talked about this a little bit last night off the air, but I want you to talk about it to our listeners, because I'm old enough, you are certainly not, and Rusty's not, to remember what was going on college campuses during the Vietnam conflict. And it was huge, and it was systemic. I mean, it was throughout the whole country. How does this one feel or seem different to you, if at all?
No, and I feel like it's possible it's similar in what I just said earlier, that you've got, you know, thousands of 18 to 22-year-olds on a campus, right, which is a real great opportunity to get into protesting and doing those kind of things. So and to a certain extent, that feels similar. I mean, I think the major difference today would be how fast, right? So if you had a protest on a campus in 1971, everything you might hear about it later would have been a still photograph or hearsay, whereas today you've got kids like recording with their iPhone. Does that make sense? Or their, you know, their smartphone, and then able to share that. So I feel like, how do I say, you know, like the access to what is happening in these protests is probably a lot more than we ever would have seen, you know, 50 years ago.
So I might sound like an old man when I ask you this question, Leah, but so how many do you think of these protesters are students? How many are not? And how many of them, I mean, there's been evidence that some there really don't know what they're doing there other than I heard it was something to do and here I am, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
I think that's a fair question to ask of you take a sample out, and there's been some video evidence put out there of, do you know what you're doing here? And the answer is no, but I'm here. You know, I mean, is it fair to make that case?
Yeah, I think it's a good question to ask, if that makes sense. So I think, like I keep saying, young people get into trouble real quick, right? So, you know, and they're on a college campus, and this is a moment that they feel like they have something to say, right? Like, I think young people feel like they have something to say, but not always, I don't know, like they're a lot of passion looking for a cause, Rusty. Does that make sense? Like, I do think that is true. Like, people are kind of like, I just want to be here because there's, you know, this is happening, and so I'm here. The other thing that's happening on Columbia's campus specifically is it's an open campus. So there are people, how do I say, if you and I visited New York City, we could just wander on that campus. That has always been true. So the deal is there are people coming from other parts of the city taking part in the protest who are not students. And then it's kind of like, you know, I don't know why they're there. Does that mean, you know what I mean? Like, and then the campus is trying to figure out who are actually students, who are just people who are from New York City who are visiting, and how do we manage all of that?
Yeah, I'd wonder, don't they need to be in class, Greg? I mean, you know, I went to college too, and it seemed like you kind of did need to go to class and take
especially
the test
this time of year. Leah's talking to us about that.
I mean, how do they have time to sit there and do all this? I don't know.
Leah, let me ask you another question. It seems like a lot of the administrators, the college presidents, some of the people are really under the radar right now of Congress, of their local, just the school population, their local, their locals there. I mean, what's going on with that? Why are they being so thrust into the spotlight here?
Oh my gosh. Is there a job right now on the planet I would never want to have as a college president, right? Like, because they can't control it, Greg, right? So what happened at Columbia was the president told Congresswoman Elise Stefanik that she would get everything under control. The students heard that and they were kind of like, you're not going to control me. So they set up a tent encampment overnight while she was like the night after she testifies to Congress. So she comes back and she's like, look, I just told Congress I was going to control this. That's when she calls in the NYPD and it's just gone south from there. Does that make sense? So I think a little bit for presidents, whatever they do is going to be wrong to some major group of people, whether it's donors or trustees or elected officials or to their students and their faculty and staff.
You know, and I think also the issue in some of these cases has not just been the fact that they're there, but also what they've been doing, right? You know, I mean, there have been some egregious acts, I think, against students, and that's where it's gotten out of line. I believe that's why some of these, you know, have been cleared out or shut down or what have you, where hey, there's nothing wrong with being there and doing your thing in general. But when you're starting to intimidate or hurt or cause harm or those kinds of things, I think that it seems to be has been the underlying issue of some of these getting cleared out.
No, Rusty, I couldn't agree with you more. So the issue has been, if this were a protest of just like, I don't like that you called the police. Does that make sense? Like, I really don't want the police here. I think that's a different question. But absolutely, inside of this protest, while I imagine there are many students who are there and they don't really know why they're there, or there are many students who are there very peacefully caring about the issue, there have been issues who have been behaving in an anti-Semitic way that makes Jewish students on campuses feel unsafe. So that is true at Columbia. It was true at Harvard. It was true at UPenn. The reason why Congresswoman Stefanik was getting into it, does that make sense? Is like that had already started happening in the wake of Gaza. So you are absolutely not wrong. There is bad acting happening.
That was Leah Murray, one of our co-hosts on KSL at Night. Thank you for joining us. And when we come back after the break, let's go to the Supreme Court and listen to some arguments that were made just within the last couple days regarding immunity for a former president. Stay with us.
Hear elevated conversation on crucial issues. Boyd Matheson on Inside Sources.
Welcome back to Inside Sources. I'm Greg Skordas alongside Rusty Cannon. And Rusty, this week we had some really, I guess, because, I mean, you're into this politics stuff. I'm sort of into the legal stuff. And we had
You got to remember, I always wished I went to law school.
Yeah, that's right. I think you would have been an incredible lawyer, by the way. There's still time. You're
it's never too late.
Yeah. That the Supreme Court was hearing arguments this week on the issue. It's a very limited issue. And of course, it's related to Donald Trump's criminal case. It's in Washington, D.C. They're listening to argument there over to what level a president, and in this case a former president, has what level of immunity he has for acts that occurred while he was in office, and then he's charged later on for a crime. Should he have immunity? Now, we know that we have this concept called governmental immunity.
Yeah.
And we shield our governmental employees. I'll give you best example I can think of, which is police officers. Sometimes they have to use force.
Yeah.
Sometimes they have to do something that if you and I did it, it would be called a homicide. But they have immunity because they have to act. They have to do things. It's part of their course of work. It's part of what they do. And so we grant them that level of immunity. We haven't had president's charged with criminal conduct, but we do now. In fact, there's a trial going on right now in New York, the hush money trial. But the one in D.C. involves the conduct that the president, former president, did allegedly to upset the results of the 2020 election.
Yeah, January 6th, essentially.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. So the Supreme Court was hearing those arguments. We've got Perry Russum from ABC News to help us break that down. Hopefully he can explain it a little better than I just did. Perry, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Of course.
And talk to us about the arguments and really, because we started at the trial court and the trial court said, no, you don't have immunity. The D.C. Circuit jumped in unanimously and said there's no level of immunity. But the Supreme Court, just in some of the arguments, was weighing it a little deeper than that and saying maybe there is some level. Is that the way we're reading the tea leaves here?
Yeah, so it gets a little muddy when the justices start talking about what's the difference between an official act and a private act. And it seems like this case is going to get kicked back to the lower courts so the lower court can figure out, in this case, what's the difference between an official act and a private act. And this is a major deal, not just for Trump. This is bigger than Trump. This is about the presidency as a whole and whether, you know, presidents can be criminally prosecuted for things that they're doing in office. I mean, one of the examples that we've been talking about here at ABC is former President Barack Obama with Anwar al-Awlaki, a U.S. citizen who was killed without due process overseas and citing national security. Could, you know, Obama be charged for something like this? So the justices want to be very, very, very careful with this case in terms of making sure they make the right decision. A decision should be coming back by June, but by all accounts, it seems like this trial for Trump will be kicked back past the election, possibly into next year.
So, Perry, the questioning that I was able to hear from justices was fascinating, where, just like you mentioned with the President Obama's example, you could go back through history of our presidents and there would be plenty to possibly, you know, cause issues, right? They brought up drone strikes. They brought up, you know, all kinds of things. Was I catching
that? Internment camps?
Yeah, internment camps, exactly.
Yeah, they brought internment camps with FDR, right, when we were in Japanese internment camps.
Yeah, so that's the issue they were getting to, I think you're alluding to, right, is that this is more than current day, right? This could be an earth-shattering,
right.
You know, this could be a big deal.
Yeah, and the reason that it's happening now is because this is the first time in U.S. history that a former president is being criminally charged. And what some of the conservative justices are worried about is creating this vicious cycle of prosecutions of the president that could just be going on for who knows how long. And they say presidents have to have some kind of protection from prosecution. But the liberal justices are kind of skeptical of this idea, you know, that absolute immunity could go unchecked. And some of the hypotheticals that they were bringing up is what happens if the president orders the military to assassinate a political rival? And what if the president orders the military to stage a coup? Would that be considered an official act? And Trump's lawyers were saying, you know, it's, if you get into the details of the hypothetical, it is possible that that could be considered an official act. So there's a lot of hypotheticals the justices are bringing up. It's clear that they see the full scope of this, you know, not just being an issue right now, but an issue the country could be looking at for the future.
Perry, you mentioned something earlier about the fact that it seems to be heading toward the Supreme Court kicking the case back down to the trial court for some findings on whether and to what extent the former president's conduct was an official act versus a private act. And by doing so, they will, by necessity, forestall the criminal case. We're going to go back to the trial court for more argument. And some people are saying that's a win all by itself for Trump because it's unlikely now that case will get to trial before the November election.
It is. I mean, that's been the game plan for Trump and his campaign and his team this entire time with every single court case that we've seen. It's delay, 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 delay. They wanted to get as close to the election as possible. They want it past the election in case Trump does win, that he could have the ability to pardon himself. And even just getting these trials closer to the election is that Trump would have the ability to use these trials to his own political advantage, saying, you know, look, see what they're doing to me. This is what they're doing to me. It's, you know, some of the playbook that we're seeing happening right now in the courtrooms outside of New York, where he goes every single day in front of cameras and says what he has to say, slamming the judge, slamming the trial, and he's slamming as many people as he can to try and, you know, stir up his base.
So, Greg, you alluded to this, and I'll ask the same question. Could this affect, or how could this affect, special counsel Jack Smith's case against Trump? Is that what you were talking about, Greg, when you mentioned?
Yeah, this is the one specifically where I was mentioning that this is probably going to get kicked back past the election because there's such a long process that it appears is going to go this way, where they're, the big hang-up really is what's an official act, what's a private act. So it seems like they want to kick this down to the lower courts for them to figure that out.
And Perry, you mentioned also that Trump could pardon himself, but he could also appoint a new executive prosecutor in the case. He could also, his Justice Department could be different, and his Justice Department might not have the wherewithal or the energy to prosecute this case. They may just drop it, correct?
Yeah, that is another possibility. And, you know, we are in territory that we as a country have never been in before. And it's clear that the justices acknowledged the moment. They were asking a lot of questions. This was a very long hearing, three hours plus, where it's clear that they understand the weight of this moment, with multiple justices saying this affects the future of the presidency as a whole. This is a turning point in the presidency. So it seems that they want to be as careful as possible and get as much information as possible before making any kind of decision.
So the statement that it's likely to go back to a lower court is based on what, the line of questioning from the various judges and reading those tea leaves?
Yeah, it's tea leaf reading by some of our reporters here who just follow the Supreme Courts unlike anybody else in the industry. So listening to them, they're the ones that know how these justices speak, the patterns, the intonations of their questions, just getting a general idea of how everything works. You know, sometimes we see where justices are certainly in favor of one side, where they're kind of showing their hand. But with this one, it seems everything's somewhat close to the vest. But, you know, most, like I was saying earlier, the majority of the justices did acknowledge that presidents have to have some type of liberty. But the question is, how much?
That was Perry Russum, ABC News reporter, covering Trump's legal case and the Supreme Court arguments there. And Rusty, I want to stay at the Supreme Court for the next segment and arguments.
I don't have to go to law school.
Entirely different arguments, but other very interesting arguments. This one deals with homelessness and the ability of states to criminalize that. We'll talk about that right after the break.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's Voice of Reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
Welcome back to Inside Sources. I am your co-host today, Rusty Cannon. I'm here with the one and only Greg Skordas. And we are moving along. We've made it so far error-free, as far as I can tell, on my first live show. So.
And we're still at the Supreme Court here.
Yeah, that's right.
We've been all over the place today, which is wonderful.
Yes, I am loving it. Always wanted to go to law school, and we get to keep talking about legal stuff. So this is great. So this week was an interesting week with the Supreme Court, as we all know. There was another case that was very important where they heard arguments before the court. Grants Pass, Oregon. Have you ever been there? I've never been there. It's not far from us. But that
apparently
town,
in the southwest.
I think so.
State,
yeah. Beautiful state. I'm sure it's a beautiful town. They're trying to regulate and reduce homelessness in their city. And they introduced a statute that bans sleeping outdoors. They're just trying to keep their streets safe, you know, clean, all that stuff. The question is this legal, or does it punish the homeless for not having anywhere else to go? So your brilliant legal mind is going to walk us through this path.
Yeah,
this is an interesting question.
Yeah. Let's talk about how it got to the Supreme Court, because there was a similar incident in Boise, Idaho. And Boise didn't necessarily criminalize homelessness. They said that people who are sleeping in the parks and whatnot would get a civil citation, and they would have to pay a fine. And, of course, the homeless population generally doesn't have money to pay a fine. And so those fines added up, and they got more and more and more. And they finally, by not paying the fine, the city said, okay, now you're committing a crime by violating a court order. You're in contempt of court, so to speak. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, first of all, it starts at the district court, the trial court. It goes up to the Ninth Circuit, and they decided that the city of Boise was acting out of the realm, doing something they shouldn't have done. Mm-hmm. Grants Pass, Oregon does the same thing. Their conduct is very similar. They're penalizing people who are sleeping in parks. Mm-hmm. And really, there's a homeless population. You know, they don't have any place to go, but the city doesn't want them there. And so the same thing happened there. The trial court said, no, city, you're doing it wrong. The Ninth Circuit said, no, you're doing it wrong. And finally, the Supreme Court said, look, not just a one-off now. We've got a couple cases. They happen to both be in the Ninth Circuit. And so the Supreme Court of the United States jumped in and said, we're going to decide this. And it's interesting, Rusty, because their decision is based on an Eighth Amendment issue, the Eighth Amendment prohibition against cruel and unusual punishment.
Yeah.
And the argument that the people representing the homeless is that it's cruel to penalize somebody for sleeping, for trying to just catch a break, trying to just get some sleep. And so what they've done is they've gone to these various cities and said, okay, in order for you to have a law that is enforceable, you have to show us that you have sufficient beds that are not being taken advantage of, that you have accommodations for homeless that are not being used. You can't just criminalize conduct if you're not doing anything to prevent it yourself.
Does so there'd have to sense? Be an open bed.
Yeah.
You're saying, hey, listen, you could go to this open bed, but you're not, and therefore we
that,
can do this.
That makes the case, that makes the city's case more palatable to these court, these justices.
So a lot of their questioning, apparently, so they spent a lot of time talking about a Supreme Court decision from 1962, Robinson v. California, where they ruled at the time that the government may prohibit conduct, such as drug use, but cannot ban status of, you know, being a drug
being
addict.
Being an addict,
yeah,
right.
Exactly. So walk us through that. What the difference there, it seems, so if you put that on this issue, you're saying, you know, could you criminalize the conduct but not the status?
And that's the problem.
Yeah.
So the conduct is trespassing in a park, sleeping in a park. You know what I mean? They're trying to solve the homeless issue, but they can't say being homeless is a crime. That would be ridiculous.
Yeah.
So what these cities are doing is they're making an end run saying, okay, being homeless is unfortunate and we should do everything we can to prevent that, but sleeping in a park is a crime, or you know, taking advantage of public resources and just deciding where you want to lay down is the crime. Not necessarily being – so it would apply to you and I even if we had a home, even if we have everything. You just – you know what I mean? They have to make it so that it's not centered on homelessness. Of course, it is. It's a means to an end. It's a way to try to solve the problem. And so they're looking at that case, looking at it the same way. We had some interesting comments by some of our justices. Justice Sotomayor explained that the law would selectively punish people for sleeping outside, targeting homeless people, but not others.
If a stargazer wants to take a blanket out at night to watch the stars and falls asleep, you don't arrest them. You only arrest people who don't have a home.
So, no, these laws are generally applicable. They apply to
everyone. Yeah, that's what you want to say. Give me one example, because your police officers couldn't, and they explicitly said, if someone has a home and is out there and happens to fall asleep, they won't be arrested.
So that's exactly what you were just talking about. I mean, that's she hit it on the head. So in other words, what's your goal here?
Yeah.
And if it's to get rid of homelessness, you may be doing it wrong. If it's for some public safety issue or something, then maybe so. But here's another argument from another one of our justices. This is Justice Elena Kagan, who said that the law doesn't just punish criminal conduct, but the status of being homeless itself.
If you were to come in here and you were to say, you know, we need certain protections to keep our streets safe, and we can't have, you know, people sleeping in any place that they want, and we can't have, you know, tent cities cropping up, I mean, that would create one set of issues. But your ordinance goes way beyond that. Your ordinance says for a person who is homeless, that person cannot take himself and himself only, can't take a blanket and sleep someplace without it being a crime. It seems like you're criminalizing a status.
Yeah, so there they go back to that very issue.
Right. And it's like you say, it would have been interesting to hear from some of the other justices who were taking a slightly different position. But it seems like at least these two justices are very skeptical of the way that the city is going about trying to solve a problem.
So I have two questions. First of all, do these attorneys ever just get speechless? Right. It just seems like you're really under the gun there with these justices hammering at you. Are there times at the Supreme Court where they're speechless and they don't have an answer?
Yeah, I've never been to the Supreme Court, but I've been to the Utah Supreme Court. I've been to the Tenth Circuit, the Utah Court of Appeals. The answer is yes. Sometimes they ask you a question and you're just like, hey, I didn't write the law. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah. Work your way out of the
question. I'm just the messenger here, Judge.
Yeah.
That doesn't fly very well.
So the second question then, is the issue here with Oregon's law that it just goes too far? Meaning, if it was more moderate or more reasonable, maybe we wouldn't be in this spot. It seems like that's kind of what they're saying, right?
Right. And secondarily, what we talked about a minute ago, which is, are there alternatives? Is there something the city should be doing and is doing?
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, we've got a homeless shelter. We've got this. We've got beds. We've got open space. We've got counseling. We've got therapy. So there's no excuse for sleeping in the in the park. You know what I mean? Because the city's doing other things. But if you're not providing that and you're just criminalizing conduct, and I think some of these arguments by these justices were a little goofy, you know, like mm-hmm. if I'm just a stargazer and I want to sleep in the park, like, come on.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? Like, no one's going to do anything. But if you're camping out there for 2 weeks at a time, maybe that's a little more problematic.
Yeah. Oh, fascinating. Again, I wished I would have gone to law school. I should have followed your path, right? This is just fascinating stuff. I mean, this applies here in Salt Lake City. This is on everybody's mind.
Oh, yeah. You remember what we were doing at Pioneer Park a couple years ago, and it was just a homeless encampment where we had it all sort of enclosed. Everybody knew where the homeless people were. But the businesses around there were going, hey, wait a minute. Why should we bear the burden of this? Whereas now they're separated. If you drive down Beck Street, I mean, there are homeless camps all along there. I mean, it's a mess. Is the city doing enough? Who knows? Is the county doing enough? It was a big issue in the last mayoral election. We'll see where this goes. We cut a couple interesting cases from the Supreme Court. Stay with us. We'll be back right after this break.
Boyd Matheson divides rage from reason on Inside Sources.
And you're with us again on Inside Sources. I'm Greg Skordas alongside Rusty Canna. Rusty, it's been fun working with you.
It has been a fun day.
And when we started the show, I want to double back on something. We started talking about the conventions which are coming up tomorrow. The Republicans at the Salt Palace, the Democrats at Cottonwood High School.
Yes.
And when we talked about some of the more interesting races, and there are a lot, I mean, I don't want you to downplay any of them, but open seats and contested races to me are interesting.
Yeah.
We didn't get to talk about one that's near and dear to me, and I'll explain in just a minute, which is the attorney general's race.
Mm-hmm.
And a spirit of full disclosure, I ran as a Democratic candidate for AG in 2004, mm-hmm. lost badly to Mark Shurtleff, very popular at the time. I ran in 2020 against Sean Reyes, very popular, mm-hmm. lost badly. So I have a little bit of experience there.
Yeah, you know a little bit about it.
But right now we've got an open seat, and those are two examples of men who served in that position for several terms. I think Shurtleff probably had four. I think Reyes has probably had three. Anyway, it's an open seat, which has been attractive to a lot of people. I want you to talk to our listeners about a couple of things, because what we talked about earlier was the path to the primary.
Mm-hmm.
Do we have signature gatherers in the AG's race that are on the ballot, or is this going to be an open forum like where you've got to get your 40% to get to the primary?
Yeah, this AG race is a little bit different. You have one signature gathering candidate on the Republican side, which is all we're talking about
right now.
Don't want to shortchange the other side. And Derrick Brown, he's gathered enough signatures. He's on the primary ballot no matter what happens tomorrow. The issue is you have three others that are vying for this Republican nomination in the attorney general's race: Frank Mylar, Trent Christensen, and Rachel Terry. None of them gathered signatures. So one of them has to come out of tomorrow with 40% or their run is over. And so that's the dynamic in that race. And Derek, former party chair, will be, you know, quite popular with delegates. Mike Lee has endorsed him soundly. And so the question is, can any of those others get to that 40% mark? That's the open question on that race tomorrow.
And if, for some reason, Derrick Brown gets 60% in the final tally, he's the man.
Then
he's the one that's going to be on the November ballot.
Correct.
Okay. So, in other words, if he gets 59, somebody else gets 41, then we're going to have a primary. All right, and I'm just assuming that,
correct,
you know, because we could very well have three people. I mean, if two people get 40%.
They could, yes.
Yeah, that's really, really interesting. Let me ask you another question about the Republican primary. Besides the endorsement of Mike Lee to Celeste Malloy's opponent, which is to me a huge surprise, do you expect any other surprises? And I know that's, you don't expect a surprise, but what could happen tomorrow that maybe we're not thinking about right now?
There's all kinds of things that can happen. I mean, so you know, having been around these for a while, there are a lot of tactics that get employed at the convention, some good, some not, where you could have all kinds of fireworks or very little fireworks, where it can be, you know, pretty much rudimentary, what have you. I'm not aware of anything that's cooking or what have you. Obviously, the news with Mike Lee in that congressional race yesterday in the endorsement, I think took a lot of people by surprise. And interesting, on Twitter, where he announced it, or X, whatever we call it now, said there's more to come.
Yeah,
I don't know if that meant with that or something else or what have you. So there's that. But yeah, the conventions, whether it's on the Republican side or the Democrat side, there is quite an atmosphere there, and you could have all kinds of things happen. Everybody speaks. There's a lot going on.
And as I recall, Blake Moore, who is a very popular, he's only been maybe two-term. Congressman, this is from the first district.
Yep,
actually has challenges within his own party, which is surprising to me because he is so popular.
Yeah, he's gathered signatures. He's already on the primary ballot, and so depending on, you know, what happens tomorrow, this is CD1. Make sure I've got the names right. Yeah, he has collected enough signatures. He also has, I believe, a challenger, Derek Draper. As well. So we'll see how that goes tomorrow. That has not collected signatures as far as I know.
And what can you tell us about what's going to happen at Cottonwood High School with the Democrats? I mean, there are a lot of interesting races there too. It looks like the Brian King sort of on the path to be the...
Yeah, his seat's open, right? Yeah. Because he's running for governor. His seat's open. So there's an active campaign there. I think a couple candidates have gathered signatures or are at the convention. Then you do have some incumbent Democrats in the Salt Lake City area that are facing challenges.
Yeah,
some have gathered signatures and some have not, and so there's a little bit of drama there on those local races, to where it'll be interesting to see how it shakes out.
Yeah, sure. And even the attorney general's race is a contested race. I think they've got two people in that one from the Democrats.
Yes, correct. They do. Yep.
Well, I'll be watching that closely, Rusty, and I'll be watching and hopefully hearing from you next week, and you can tell us how that all shook out.
We'll all survive one way or another. It'll
have
be a
nice
long
weekend,
day.
Our listeners, and thank you for joining us. Rusty, it was fun to be with you.
Hey, thank you.
FM Midvale.
KSL Salt Lake City.
From the KSL Common Spirit Health Studios, this is KSL News Radio.
Utah's news, traffic, and weather station.